welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, March the 15th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting rain early and then snow after that, which is very likely, and it'll be very windy. Winds will be from the east at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Cedar Rapids will see a high of 36, 37 in Iowa City, and then falling to a low tonight of 28 in Cedar Rapids and 29 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 7:14 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow morning is at 7:16 a.m. for a total daylight period of 11 hours and 56 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, the lead article entitled Home Ownership Program Regroups After the Derecho. It's a story by Marissa Payne of the Gazette staff. Hard work and a little help made Rhonda Esser's home ownership dreams a reality. Esser, age 63, rents an apartment in Hiawatha and has been hunting for a house for some time. After her father died, she inherited his dog Harley, a 6-pound Chihuahua, which she said made it even more difficult to find a well-managed rental in her price range. Eventually, the apartment complex where she had lived folded, and she said she was notified that she had a month to move out. When I was kicked out and only had 30 days to find a place to move, it's like, no, I can't keep this. I want a place of my own, Esser said. A colleague at Transamerica, where Esser works, told her about the Neighborhood Finance Corporation, a program designed to spur reinvestment in neighborhoods and revitalize ones on the edge of decline. Large swaths of Cedar Rapids are eligible in the program. Initially, Esser said her credit score wasn't high enough for the program, so staff provided her with tips to improve it. After a few months, she said she got her credit score up and higher than it needed to be to participate in the program, so she began to search for a house. She recently closed on a home in northeast Cedar Rapids. She said the program gave her a mortgage loan financed for about $112,000 and a $10,000 forgivable loan for home improvements provided she stays there for 5 years. In between my hard work and their help, it was a dream come true, Esser said. After a turbulent 2020, with the pandemic and especially the August 10 derecho, the Neighborhood Finance Corporation is refocusing to meet homeowners' needs. Stephanie Murphy, the executive director of the program, which is based in Des Moines and oversees the Cedar Rapids affiliate, said the team fell short of its lending goal for the year to serve 60 people and instead served 39. Disruption from the pandemic was minimal, as interest rates fell and stirred interest among those hoping to make repairs and refinance their loans, Murphy said. But then the derecho's hurricane-force winds struck Iowa, and people's priorities shifted to more immediate needs, such as fixing roofs and navigating insurance policies to make repairs. That paused or completely stopped people who had loans in process. We're 99% sure that we would have served those 60 if it hadn't been for the derecho, Murphy said. We were definitely on track to meet that goal. Staff pivoted to help address community needs after the unprecedented storm. Separate from its typical lending programs, the organization partnered with other interest and area groups for the Linn County Patch program, which provides a revolving loan fund that homeowners can tap into to make derecho repairs. While the community continues to recover from the storm, Murphy said staff are confident about reaching this year's target of serving 50 people. It's less than what we had planned on for last year, but we feel like it's realistic because it's just going to take some time for people to move beyond addressing those immediate needs and then sort of regrouping and looking at larger projects, Murphy said. The effort serves people of all incomes in the lending area, which was expanded last year. A map of the area is available at neighborhoodfinance.org/lending-map/cedar-rapids. From January 2019 to January 2021, the program provided 81 repayable and forgivable loans worth nearly $5.7 million. The Cedar Rapids City Council in 2018 agreed to commit $1 million a year for 5 years to cover the forgivable portion of loans. Council member Scott Overland, who championed the public-private partnership as it got off the ground in the city, said housing inventory has been low in the local market, so prices have gone up. This likely will entice people to sell and in turn help the Neighborhood Finance Corporation, he said. Overland anticipates pent-up demand from those looking to buy a house this year. We're very confident in 2021, barring anything out of left field, we'll hit our targets this year instead of 2020, Overland said. But the way I look at it is any organization like that that can take a blow that certainly wasn't anticipated, we're going to come out of it stronger than we went into it. A better 2020 is on the horizon for Esser, too. Soon, she will fully move into her house with her son, Chris. It needs some repairs to the roof, chimney, siding, and gutters, among other things. But she's excited to move in, and in particular, to decorate her living room. She plans to put plants in front of several windows. And with a yard, her dog will have ample room to run around. She might add another pet to the family now that she has a home of her own. The monthly payments that I'm putting into the house is something that I own, instead of just kind of throwing it towards somebody else's mortgage payment, Esser said. Also from today's front page, Tanager Lands State's First Freedom Schools Program, an article by Grace King of the Gazette staff. Tanager Place is bringing, for the first time in Iowa, a summer program with its roots in the 1960s civil rights movement, designed to increase literacy, self-esteem, socio-emotional skills, and a love of learning for children. Tanager Place is working with the Cedar Rapids Community School District to identify 30 students who would most benefit from CDF Freedom Schools program, particularly students who are racial minorities or come from low-income households. The six-week program from the Children's Defense Fund is free to students and will be held at either the McKinley or Johnson STEAM Academy. CDF Freedom Schools is rooted in the 1964 Mississippi Freedom Summer Project, which provided a reading and humanities curriculum of English, art, creative writing, math, and science. It was relaunched in 1993 by Marion Wright Edelman and has served more than 150,000 children since 1995. There are 182 program sites across the United States. In addition to learning, students will get to go on field trips to college campuses, museums, the library, baseball games, and Camp Tanager, where they can swim, do archery, and engage in other camp activities. If it's not fun, the kids aren't going to want to do it, said Tanager Place Chief Executive Officer Okparup Rice. The program strives to give children the opportunity to enhance learning through literacy characters who look like them and have had similar experiences. It can help students avoid summer learning loss, build their home library, increase confidence, boost interest in social and civic engagement, advocacy, and address mental health risk factors. Each week, students will get a book they get to keep, and staff will have weekly meetings with participating students' parents or guardians. Students will learn how to advocate for themselves and their community, said Maggie Hartzler, the CDF Freedom Schools Program Administrator at Tanager. If a kid is a beautiful artist, They can be in charge of decorating some signs we can take to a protest or march, Hartzler said. You are great at writing. We'll have a social justice day, and you can write a speech to give to your peers. For the first year, Tanager is offering CDF Freedom School for students going into 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. Organizers hope to expand the program this fall to include after-school programs and summer school for more grade levels next year. 5 interns will be hired to deliver the program. Tanager Place has reached out to area colleges and universities to find students interested in applying, specifically students in the school's Black Student Unions, Hartzler said. So much of this program is rooted in civil rights and striving for equity and inclusion, Hartzler said. The positions are paid, including 2 weeks of training. They really want you to hire college-age students so young people can see other young people who are successful in college, who have furthered their education and be inspired, Rice said. The program will be in person, and Tanager Place will be following recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this summer, including possibly requiring masks and social distancing. Rice said he has been interested in bringing CDF Freedom Schools to Tanager since he became the CEO in 2015. We don't take on programs we don't believe we can execute successfully, Rice said. To bring the program to Tanager Place, Rice and Hartzler applied and were interviewed. The feedback from the interview with CDF Freedom School was that Tanager Place had one of the most comprehensive and well-written applications the program had ever seen, Rice said. The cost is being funded by donations, Rice said. It costs $285 per student, plus the cost of personnel and food. The program will run June 14 to July 23. As a white woman administering the program through Tanager Place, Hartzler said she's doing the work to understand her own privilege and listening to voices of color. Tanager Place helps children and families in eastern Iowa overcome challenges and find mental wellness. It offers treatment and outreach, prevention, and gives children tools to be successful. Families interested in CDF Freedom School or other Tanager Place resources can reach Tanager Place at 319-365-9164. If a kid is a beautiful artist, they can be in charge of decorating some signs, and we can take to a protest or march. You're great at writing. We'll have a social justice day, and you can write a speech to your peers. Turning to today's insight or opinion page, we have an article entitled Cedar Rapids Mayor's Race Can End Business as Usual. And this is a guest column by Steve Shriver, who is founder and CEO of Ecolips Incorporated. Cedar Rapids is living the lesson that every entrepreneur knows. Resilience and perseverance are essential to work through tough times. I am continually inspired by stories of people coming together to help neighbors. I believe in a city where small businesses and corporations alike thrive with the support of local government and community. When we are aligned as a community, anything can happen. I have been innovating for decades, and in the last 20 years, I have seen the new Bohemia District transform from a neighborhood of dilapidated warehouses to a vibrant community center. We have all witnessed the possibilities when there is great leadership in place. In recent years, however, when most of our local businesses have struggled to stay open and many people continue to struggle to survive in the wake of the derecho and pandemic, we know Cedar Rapids can and must do better. While I have challenged the status quo for years and led positive change in our community, unfortunately, this is not a good time for me to run for office. Instead, I will support another person who is immensely qualified and shares my vision for a better community. For starters, we must ask ourselves, are we better off now than we were 4 years ago? For most of us, myself included? The answer is no. The economy has slowed. Small businesses are struggling. And our government can't seem to figure out how to be there for the people when we need them most. From missteps with the Nubo Evolve event to the derecho, these epic disasters bookend the story of why Mayor Brad Hart has failed to deliver for Cedar Rapids. We need leadership that will listen to us and is open to change. Instead, our highest-ranked elected official continues to operate with a pattern that is dismissive of grassroots movements. When the rest of the country was working on equity with grassroots activists, the initial response from many Cedar Rapids leaders was outright rejection. This mentality needs to change. Luckily, our city has the opportunity to change all of this and make history. With this upcoming municipal election in November, we have the chance to put an end to the business-as-usual style of politics that seems to benefit only the wealthy and well-connected, and start a new chapter where the needs of ordinary people are put first. We have the chance to elect new, compassionate leaders who will be there for the people. This year, we have a chance to elect the first woman of color to lead this city. I would like to see Amara Andrews announce she's running for mayor. I can't think of anyone better positioned to lead our city. I've known about Amara for a few years, but I really came to know her over the summer during a time when many of us were asking ourselves, what can we do to help so many of our neighbors who have been oppressed? Amara helped organize several community efforts to shine a light on systemic injustice and assist those most in need. She organized food drives and voter registration opportunities. She helped young people find their voice, and she worked tirelessly during the aftermath of the derecho. She did all of this while taking care of her family and maintaining her role as a leader within a local family-run business. Amara knows what working families in this community need, and she knows that, with proper leadership, our government can do a much better job than it has done in delivering for the people. She's a businesswoman, a mother, and a dedicated community leader. Her credentials are powerful, including an undergraduate degree from the University of California at Berkeley and a JD from the UCLA School of Law. Before relocating to Cedar Rapids with her family, Amara held several positions at the University of Illinois, where she developed an incubator program for startup companies, taught entrepreneurship, and advised MBA students. It is my sincere hope that she enters the race for mayor and that all of you support her. It's time for a change, and Amara can deliver. Let's make sure the person we elect represents us all. And that piece by Steve Shriver, founder and CEO of Ecolips Incorporated. Turning to today's letters to the editor, the first one comes from Daryl Syverson of Strawberry Point. And his letter is entitled, GOP Bill to Control Diversity Curriculum is Filled with Irony. It's difficult not to see the irony in State Representative Steve Holt's argument for regulating what is being taught and discussed in our Iowa schools. Quote, I'm concerned students are being taught topics that are untrue, divisive, and toxic to the future of our country, end quote. Where was his concern when Professor Donald Trump was effectively teaching untrue, divisive, and toxic topics to his adoring students? And that letter by Daryl Syverson of Strawberry Point. The next letter is entitled Voter Suppression in the 2nd Congressional District, a letter by Adam Peters of Davenport. Voter suppression is running rampant in Iowa at both federal and state levels. At the federal level, there are 22 disenfranchised voters in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District whose votes were wrongfully excluded from the election. At the state level, Republicans just passed voter suppression legislation that, among other things, reduces access to early and absentee voting. This bill was signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds last week. Unlike the threat posed to voting rights by the new legislation, Congress can rectify the exclusion of the 22 legitimate ballots with a complete and transparent recount. Unwilling to accept the disenfranchisement of voters, Rita Hart and her lawyers have been tirelessly fighting for an accurate and consistent recount of all the ballots in the second district's congressional election. Hart's lawyer, Mark Elias, has a long-standing track record of fighting voter suppression in order to strengthen democracy. In contrast, Marionette Miller Meeks and her lawyers continue to promote voter suppression and silence the voices of Iowans. Miller Meeks' lawyer, Alan Ostergren, consistently fights to strengthen voter suppression. When he's not working on disenfranchising voters in the second district's congressional election, he's lobbying for the voter suppression bill that just became law. It's important to recognize voter suppression and do everything possible to prevent it from happening. Hart and her lawyers want to make sure that every vote is counted so no voters are disenfranchised. I wish Miller Meeks and her lawyers had the same motive. That letter by Adam Peters of Davenport. The next letter is entitled, Representative Ashley Hinson Doesn't Fight for Those in Need. And this by Mary Durant of Lisbon. In January, U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson tweeted, regardless of if you voted for me or not, I will fight for you in D.C. and work to serve you every day. I will be your voice and a voice of reason in Congress. After a month in office and votes on high-profile pieces of legislation, the scope of who Hinson will fight for seems pretty limited. Our nation's civil rights laws protect people on the basis of race, color, origin, and in most cases, sex, disability, and religion. Currently, federal law does not explicitly provide non-discrimination protections based on sexual orientation or gender equity. That's why the Equality Act is needed. When the vote came up, Hinson voted against it, incorrectly saying there are already existing legal protections for those who have experienced discrimination under federal law. Hinson's vote assured that religious bigotry and discrimination were okay under her watch. When the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act came to a vote, Hinson voted against it. The law contains numerous provisions, including a chokehold ban, making lynching a federal crime, and ending racial profiling. People of color would be most impacted by this legislation. In a tweet, Hinson incorrectly stated the bill would defund the police, so she voted no. When provided the opportunity to put her vote where her words were, Hinson did not, in fact, fight for those in need. Instead, she resigned to the status quo and followed her party's voting recommendations. And that letter by Mary Durant of Lisbon. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, March the 15th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. From Cedar Rapids, Sarah Andrea Nelson, age 39, died on Friday, March the 12th, at her home. From Monticello, Paul D. Jameson, age 69, passed away on Sunday, March the 14th, at his home. In keeping with Paul's wishes, public services will not be held. Iowa Cremation is assisting the family. And from Cedar Rapids, Joseph, also known as Joe Albert Kuhn, Sr., age 90, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, March the 12th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Services are at 10 a.m. Wednesday at St. Patrick Catholic Church. Burial is in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Friends are welcome to attend a vigil service for Joe at 4 p.m. Tuesday at the Tea and Funeral Home. Those not attending the vigil service may visit with the family from 4:30 to 7 p.m. And from Marion, Melvin Lee Jensen, age 71, passed away on Friday, March the 12th, at Willow Gardens Care Center in Marion. The family plans to hold a celebration of Melvin's life later this summer. And from Cedar Rapids, Edwin Rask, age 84, died on Saturday, March the 13th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, March the 16th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service is at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March the 17th, at the funeral home. Burial is in Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From Central City, David J. Goodlove, age 80, passed away on Thursday, March the 11th, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. The family will greet friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, March the 17th, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, March the 18th, at the funeral home, and burial will take place at Jordan's Grove Cemetery in Central City. And in other death notices, from Belle Plaine, Lenny K. Brandt, age 74, died Saturday, March the 17th. Robeck Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plaine is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Ronald E. Dame, age 69, died Friday, March the 12th. Iowa Cremation in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Also from Cedar Rapids, Janine L. White, age 72, died Friday, March the 12th. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Coggin, Dennis Russell, age 76, died Saturday, March the 13th. The Getch Funeral Home in Monticello is assisting the family. From Decorah, Florence Gehling, age 86, died Saturday, March the 13th. The Schluter Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. And from Waukon, Ann J. Haney, age 80, died Friday, March the 12th. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. And as most of you know, on Monday, the prep sports is pretty limited. We have none today, actually. But we do have a story about the Iowa University of Iowa men's basketball team, and it's entitled Planted. The Hawkeyes hope to reap great rewards in the NCAAs. And it's a story by Mike Kloss of the Gazette staff. You have the luxury to look all you want at potential matchups for Iowa in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. Oregon would be a pretty feisty second-round foe, having gone 14-4 to finish in first place in the Pacific 12 Conference's regular season. How about Kansas in the Sweet 16? Let the drool start forming for that one. And who's up for a rematch with unbeaten Gonzaga in the Elite 8 and a chance to wreck the Zags' perfect season? Stow it. Hawkeyes coach Frank McCaffrey will tell his team this week. It's all Grand Canyon all the time as McCaffrey's number 2 seed in the West region takes on a team from out west on Saturday in the 15th seed Antelopes. The game tips at 5:25 p.m. Saturday on TBS at Farmers Coliseum in Indianapolis. Grand Canyon is 17-6. It was 9-3 in the Western Athletic Conference regular season, then beat Seattle and New Mexico State by a combined 52 points over the weekend in winning the WAC tournament, securing its first NCAA tournament berth in its 8 years as a Division I program. If you didn't know the Grand Canyon had a basketball team, it doesn't. The Antelopes and their university are located in Phoenix. They're also serious about the sport. The school fired former Phoenix Suns star Dan Majerle as their coach last spring and hired Bryce Drew, who took two Valparaiso teams to the NCAA tourney and guided Vanderbilt there in 2018. But his third Vanderbilt club went 0-18 in the Southeastern Conference last season, and Drew was fired. Off he went to Grand Canyon, and this week, Drew is taking his team to the state, where he was a college player and a coach. It was his last second shot for Valparaiso in the 1998 NCAAs that beat Mississippi and went down in tournament lore. McCaffrey can relate to Grand Canyon, having coached Lehigh and UNCSEED Greensboro as number 16 seeds in the big tournament and leading 2-13 seeds and a 9 in the NCAAs when he was at Siena. "We were a 9 and beat Ohio State," McCaffrey said. "We were a 13 and beat Vanderbilt. It was a 4. We were a 16 and lost, but I will tell you this. Every team that I've taken to the NCAA tournament has been a really, really good basketball team with terrific players, and that's the message to our guys. What they have to do is be respectful. Any team that made this tournament won their way there. This isn't a lottery. You've got to earn it." Grand Canyon has played just one ranked team. That was Arizona State, which beat the Antelopes 71-70 when Remy Martin made a jumper with 9 seconds left. The Lopes beat Steve Alford's 16-win Nevada team 87-77. All that said, the Hawkeyes could find satisfaction last night before their COVID-19 testing with the knowledge that they're the first Iowa team to be seeded as high as number 2 since 1987. That team reached the Elite 8, by the way. Since the NCAA tourney expanded to 64 teams in 1988, number 15 seeds are 8-132 against number 2 seeds. The most recent number 15 to prevail was Middle Tennessee, a 90-81 winner over Michigan State in 2016. Number 16 seed Maryland, Baltimore County, shocked number 1 Virginia 74-54 in 2018. McCaffrey said, "I have as good a sense as anybody of what Grand Canyon will be feeling this week as a big underdog. You're going to face an incredibly motivated, really talented, very well-coached basketball team," he said. "And anything short of our best effort, and you have a hard time winning. We've seen that repeatedly. I firmly believe that there's no such thing as an upset in this tournament." Nonetheless, the Hawkeyes could take some satisfaction Sunday in being a number 2 seed. In 4 previous NCAA appearances under McCaffrey, they've been an 11, a 7, another 7, and 10. "I think everyone was really, really excited, especially to see ourselves as a 2 seed this year in the Big Ten. To be able to win the games that we've won and put ourselves in that position is huge." Iowa forward Joe Wieskamp said his team's mission this long week of waiting to play is just locking in mentally and realizing Grand Canyon's the team that we have to beat to move on, and that should be our only focus right now. We're not worried about who we could play in the second round or so forth. Here's your Dear Abby column for today. It's entitled, "Mom Feels Powerless to Help Her Adult Daughter." Dear Abby, "My daughter is in her early 20s. When she was younger, she was happy. She socialized, had friends, and had fun. She has had several boyfriends, but unfortunately nothing that panned out. She feels the only way to be comfortable or worth anything is to have a guy by her side. I think she goes about it in the wrong way. She has few friends now and rarely goes anywhere other than work. She experiences periods of depression and says she's afraid of being rejected, which holds her back from socializing. I try to encourage her to step out of her comfort zone and experience life, but she gets defensive and thinks I'm saying it to be mean. I'm afraid if she doesn't change her lifestyle, the situation will become worse. These should be some of the best years of her life. Can you offer any suggestions to help her through these dark times? And that's signed, Mom Who's Worried in Pennsylvania. And Abby responds, Dear Mom, the most important step a person can take to solve a problem is to admit there is one. Pointing out that someone seems depressed and isolated isn't mean. It's what caring parents or friends do when they see someone is in trouble. When advising your daughter, make sure your tone is perceived as loving and not just judgmental. Then point out that the quickest way for her to get her life back on track would be to talk to a licensed mental health professional. And returning to some of the top stories for today, an article by Breanne Paffensteel of the Gazette staff entitled, Most Iowans Polled Say Grassley Should Not Run Again. 28% of those responding to Iowa poll hope Senator seeks another term by 2022. A majority of Iowans, including a third of Iowa Republicans, say they hope U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley decides not to seek re-election in 2022, a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll shows. The 87-year-old Republican has served in elected office continuously since 1959, when he joined the state legislature, and he's mulling an eighth run for the U.S. Senate in the coming midterms. He would be 95 at the end of another six-year term. According to the poll, just 28% of Iowans hope Grassley decides to run again, and 55% say they hope he does not. Another 17% are unsure. The poll of 775 Iowa adults was conducted March 7 through 10 by Selzer and Company of Des Moines for the Des Moines Register and MediaCom. The poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Austin McMenemy, a 38-year-old poll respondent from Denison, said it's really hard to say that Grassley shouldn't seek another term given his history in the state, but it's just the age thing. With some of these people who are in their 80s, you kind of want them to be out being a grandparent, not in office, he said. Go enjoy life. There are younger people who can take on that role with similar politics and everything. McMenemy is among the 35% of Republicans who say they hope Grassley decides not to seek another term in office. 50% of Republicans say they would like to see him mount another campaign, and 15% are unsure. J. Ann Selzer, president of Selzer & Company, said it's notable that 35% of Republicans say they'd like to see Grassley step aside. I can almost feel the tension as Republican respondents are dealing with it, she said. He's the most popular senator since the inception of the Iowa poll, and probably the closest thing to a sure bet that they would have for the party. 27% of independents say they hope Grassley decides to run again. 54% say they hope he does not, and 20% are unsure. Among Democrats, 11% say they hope Grassley decides to run again. 77% say they hope he does not, and 12% are unsure. The polling comes as Grassley is weighing his re-election options. He told reporters last month he expects to make a decision sometime in September, October, or November of this year. Grassley, who gets up early, 6 days a week, to jog a couple of miles before work, said Iowans should harbor no doubts about his ability to do the job. If I can do that every day, I hope nobody has any questions about my ability to conduct a campaign, he said. I'll be up to the voters to decide. It'd be up to the voters to decide whether or not I should be reelected, but I hope they won't say I can't conduct a campaign. Currently, the Senate is split 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats, with Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris serving as the tie-breaking vote. That makes the 2022 elections especially consequential, as even one flipped seat could dramatically alter the political landscape in Washington, D.C. Already, five Republican senators who face re-election in 2022 have announced they plan to retire: Roy Blunt of Missouri, Rob Portman of Ohio, Richard Burr of North Carolina, Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, and Richard Selby of Alabama. Their absence could increase the pressure on Grassley to seek another term. With his long history of Iowa politics, he's seen as an exceptionally difficult candidate to beat. In his last election, Grassley defeated former Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge by 22 percentage points. That lopsided victory came even as Grassley fended off national criticism for his decision not to hold confirmation hearings for President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland in 2016. Penny Pedersen, a 70-year-old Republican poll respondent from Garner, said she'd like to see Grassley run again. "I like his conservative values," she said. "I know he's looked out and been a good representative for farmers in the state." She acknowledged that age is a concern to a certain degree, but what I've read about his lifestyle and him is really on the ball and very active, very energetic, she said. Although he would likely remain a formidable candidate, Grassley has declining job approval and favorability numbers. His 48% job approval rating is his lowest in nearly four decades. The first two Iowa polls conducted when Grassley entered the U.S. Senate in 81 and 1982 showed him with a 44% and 42% approval rating, respectively. Since then, he's enjoyed approval ratings that have reached stratospheric heights, Selzer said, occasionally hitting 80% or higher. But his numbers have trended downward in recent years, and his approval rating today is 5 percentage points lower than it was in June 2020. Then, 53% of Iowans said they approved of the job Grassley was doing, 31% said they disapproved, and 15% were unsure. Today, 38% disapprove and 14% are unsure. Grassley's favorability numbers have held steady, with 48% saying they view him favorably and 37% saying they view him unfavorably. In September 2020, the most recent previous poll, 48% of Iowans had a favorable view of him and 35% said they had an unfavorable view of him. Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst also has seen her job approval ratings tick downward. For the first time since taking office, the Iowa poll shows more Iowans disapprove than approve of her job performance. Today, 43% of poll respondents say they approve of the job she's doing, while 45% disapprove and 12% are unsure. In June 2020, 49% approved and 39% disapproved and 13% were unsure. And from today's community page, Tuning Up Family Folk Machine, an Iowa City ensemble rounding out the pandemic concert series online, a story by Diana Nolan of the Gazette staff. The Gazette-like, well-oiled gadgetry, Iowa City's Family Folk Machine, has found a way to switch gears, shifting rehearsals and concerts online. The final results will debut on YouTube at 3 p.m. Sunday. The intergenerational choir was in the midst of preparing its 2020 spring concert when the pandemic brought that to a screeching halt. "It's so weird to be at this anniversary," said Jean Littlejohn, age 49, of Iowa City, who founded the group in January 2013, conducts the choir, and serves as the nonprofit organization's executive and artistic director. "Every day I can remember exactly what I was doing a year ago." She and her family were in Germany, where her husband, a University of Iowa sociology professor, Michael Sauder, was on sabbatical. Their planned 7-month stay was cut short when they realized they would need to return to Iowa City before international borders closed. So Little John contacted Associate Directors Gayla Drake and John Raynard, who had been directing the choir in her absence. Together, they drafted an email informing the members that rehearsals for the May 9, 2020 concert would be suspended. At first, we didn't even know that we would have to cancel a concert, Little John said. That step came next. Then the board met in May to figure out how to proceed. The choir put a lot of work into the songs, and the concert was going to be really cool, Little John said. It was celebrating the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, and the songs were great, and the arrangements were great. They decided to postpone the concert until the fall. It wasn't long before they realized that that wouldn't happen either, when they started seeing other choirs using virtual technology. They decided to go the video route too, but instead of showing a virtual choir with a grid of performers in little boxes, one of the board members suggested having their choristers record their voices at home. Those voices would then be mixed to provide the soundtrack to visuals incorporating nature, photos, or animation. Members April Clark, Susan Stames, and Susan Spears volunteered to handle the visual elements and began learning animation. This has been one of the most amazing success stories, Little John said. These three individuals ended up creating videos that were just way more creative and imaginative than anything I would have thought possible. Once we could see that our progress was going to work, we expanded, and we ended up recording all 15 songs that would have been on the May concert. And then we decided to present them in three chunks to make it a little more manageable. The first video in the Our Planet series debuted on the group's YouTube channel November 15, followed by the second section January 1. Sunday's final segment features songs by Dolly Parton, ELO, and Billy Swan, as well as an original piece by Stains and another by the Choir's Kids about Hickory Hill Park. Little John's daughter Claire Souter edited the children's video. Little John brought the idea for the ensemble to Iowa City from Boston, where the family moved for 2 years for her husband's research fellowship. While there, she and her children, Claire and Ben, participated in two intergenerational choirs. It was such a neat experience, she said, just having something you could do with young kids where you could be equal participants. When we moved back to Iowa City, I thought that idea would work really well in this community. I didn't really know how to start an organization, but I talked to some people and we got it started about 6 months later in 2013. The reason we were able to really get things going was because we teamed up with the Iowa City Johnson County Senior Center. For the first 5 years of our existence, we were just part of the Senior Center's programming. And then we became an independent nonprofit in 2018, which was another steep learning curve. But we're really feeling good about that now, and it's allowed us to expand our programming a lot and grow into new directions. The group has performed in several locations, including the Senior Center and the Old Capitol's Senate Chamber. But as membership grew, the ensemble outgrew those spaces and moved performances to the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City. Musicians typically join them on a wide range of instruments, from banjo, piano, guitar, drums, bass, to fiddle and mandolin, ukulele, and other folk sounds. All ages of singers are welcome to join without auditioning. Before the pandemic hit, the ranks had swelled to 80 participants, ages 4 to 80, mostly from Iowa City, Coralville, and nearby. Rehearsals have been held at the Senior Center from 3 to 5 p.m. on Sundays. Youth participants had their own 30-minute rehearsals and then joined their parents. children's activities, and a babysitter also were available. Teens and University of Iowa students have sung with the group as well. We had a really robust group of teenagers the past few years, Little John said. It'll be interesting to see once we go back to in-person if that has to be sort of reconstituted from scratch or if they'll still be there. Participation fees generally are $50 for adults and $30 for children over age 5, with a cap of $125 per family. But during the pandemic, those fees have been optional. We just want to welcome everybody to participate, even if they can't pay, Little John said. We actually do that normally as well. The organization's operating budget is small, between $17,000 and $18,000, and donations typically are accepted at in-person concerts. The financial flow has changed with the pandemic, too, and Little John is grateful that grants from several community organizations have helped cover costs for the equipment needed to stage virtual events. The musical scope also has changed over the years. We have this work folk in our name, and I've had a lot of occasion to reflect on what that could possibly mean, said Little John, who has a Master of Music degree in organ performance from Indiana University and a PhD in music theory from Northwestern University in Illinois. When we first started, I think what it meant was that we have this sort of foundation in the tradition of Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and all these different strands of American folk music. But lately, I've been thinking about the music that we perform. It spans a lot more genres than that. In some ways, I think there's this broader meaning of folk, that we perform music that gains something from group expression. So that ends up including various strands of popular music and things like the Beatles. Sometimes we do some very recent music, too, especially if it suits a popular theme that we're working on, she said. It's actually a huge question and something we've talked about a lot on our board because it's very important to us to be inclusive. And so we've had a lot of discussion about it. Is that word folk actually making it seem like we're only interested in certain types of music or certain parts of American culture? I feel like there's a lot that's good about the word, too. And so I guess I just want to advocate for a very broad interpretation of that word and hope that it works. And we have a few Eastern Iowa briefs today, the first coming from Iowa City, entitled Climate Grants Are Now Open to Students. The City of Iowa City is making funding available for community-led climate action initiatives, including for students. The Climate Action Grant Program is designed to empower Iowa City students, businesses, and organizations to take climate action and lead fellow community members in supporting activities that promote energy efficiency, reduce reliance on single-occupant vehicles, encourage care for natural spaces, and enhance quality of life for all. Applications for this grant will be accepted through April 1. Successful project proposals must focus on climate action goals in Iowa City and be accomplished by June 30, 2022. Organizations and businesses are eligible for grants up to $10,000, and new this year, students in kindergarten through 12th grade are eligible for grants up to $500. A total of $60,000 is reserved for this program and will be available beginning July the 1st. The online grant form can be found on the city's website at icgov.org/climateactiongrants. In 2018, the city adopted a climate action and adaptation plan to address fundamental initiatives in reaching the city's goals to reduce carbon emissions by 45% based on 2010 levels by 2030 and approach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. To learn more about the grant requirements and how to apply, visit the website or contact Ashley Monroe, Assistant City Manager, at 319-356-5012 or ashley-monroe at iowa-city.org. And from Cedar Rapids, a food box giveaway set for March 27. Today, We Achieve will be sponsoring its 12K in 2021 program, in which 12,000 food boxes will be distributed throughout the community in 2021. The March Drive Through Food Box Giveaway event is scheduled from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. March 27 at Hawkeye Downs at 4400 6th Street Southwest. This is a first-come, first-served event, and no registration is needed. People should be prepared to wait in their cars, and face masks and social distancing are required. Volunteers are needed to place food boxes into vehicles, help with traffic control, and to help move pallets and crates if they have trucks. Cash or check donations may be made at the giveaway site or mailed to Together We Achieve at 1150 27th Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. And nonprofit hosts Spring Tree Sale Fundraiser. Families Helping Families of Iowa is again selling trees as a fundraiser for the Cedar Rapids area-based nonprofit. Executive Director Melissa Carlson is working with a local tree farmer to sell Iowa-grown trees at discounted prices to residents looking to replace trees lost in the August 2020 derecho. We had a very successful fall tree sale fundraiser, and we wanted to give more people an opportunity to purchase trees this spring, Carlson said. Local trees could be difficult to come by this spring. We are fortunate to have a tree farmer willing to reserve a few hundred for us to sell. Four varieties of maples are available that are 3 inches in diameter and about 16 to 18 feet tall. There is also an evergreen option. Delivery and planting are within the Cedar Rapids metro area are available for an additional fee. All proceeds will help provide services for Iowa children residing in foster care. For pricing and more information, visit fhfia.org or call 319-294-9706 or email melissac at fhfia.org. And that does it for reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, March the 15th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.